This is VOA News via remote. I'm Laurel Bowman, and here are some of the latest developments in the coronavirus crisis worldwide. The virus has claimed over 1.2 million lives around the world since it first emerged in China late last year. The number of people infected globally approaches 50 million. That's according to running tallies by Johns Hopkins University in the United States. The United States remains the most affected country with over 237,000 deaths. The countries with the next highest death tolls are Brazil with more than 162,000, India with more than 126,000, and Mexico with over 94,000. President-elect Joe Biden vows to name a group of top scientists to his coronavirus task force as early as Monday, making the pledge during his first speech since being projected as winner of the U.S. election. Portugal will introduce a curfew across most of the country from Monday in an effort to combat surging case numbers, Prime Minister Antonio Costa announces. The UK government caves into a campaign by Manchester United star Marcus Rashford, promising to give free meals to poor children over the Christmas holidays. Britain pays tribute to its war dead as royals and politicians commemorate a low-key Remembrance Day without the usual solemn pageantry, owing to the pandemic. A gymnastics competition in Japan provides a glimpse of what the delayed Tokyo Olympics may look like next summer as fans attend the country's first international sporting competition since the shutdown. The Gymnastics Friendship and Solidarity Competition gathers around 30 athletes from Japan, China, Russia, and the U.S. to compete in tightly controlled biosecure conditions. For more on these stories, we invite you to visit our website at voanews.com. This is VOA News. Thousands of people across the United States took to the streets this weekend to celebrate the announcement that Joe Biden is the projected winner of the 2020 presidential election. In his first speech since then, President-elect Biden says he was humbled by the trust and confidence that voters have placed in him and that his presidency will be about rebuilding America. He also appealed to those who had cast their vote for incumbent President Donald Trump, saying it's time to put away harsh rhetoric and come together as Americans. Vice President-elect Kamala Harris, who makes history as the first woman vice president or president of the U.S., said in her first speech to the public post-announcement that she may be the first woman vice president, but she won't be the last. Harris was born to immigrant parents from Jamaica and India. Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny congratulated President-elect Biden on his victory Sunday before there was any reaction from the Kremlin to the U.S. election results. In a tweet, Navalny congratulated Biden, running mate Kamala Harris, and Americans for, quote, defining the new leadership in a free and fair election. This is a privilege which is not available to all countries, said Navalny, who is recovering in Germany from a suspected poisoning earlier this year, which he blames Putin for, but the Kremlin denies this. Congratulations were pouring in from around the world after U.S. television networks declared Saturday that Biden's lead over Trump was insurmountable. World leaders, including German Chancellor Angela Merkel, French President Emmanuel Macron, and British Prime Minister Boris Johnson, congratulated Biden. But by mid-afternoon Sunday, there was no statement yet from Russian President Vladimir Putin. Iran's President Hassan Rouhani on Sunday said that the next U.S. administration has an opportunity to, quote, compensate for its previous mistakes, end quote, following Joe Biden's victory in the presidential election. U.S. President Donald Trump has applied a maximum pressure policy and crippling sanctions against Iran since his 2018 withdrawal from a landmark nuclear agreement with Tehran. The reimposed sanctions targeted Iran's vital oil industry and banking ties, among other sectors. Rouhani added that the U.S. administration's harmful and wrong policy for the past 3 years was not only condemned by people all around the world, but was also opposed by the people of the U.S. in the recent election. These are his words. Biden has said during his campaign that he plans to embark on a credible path to return to diplomacy with Iran and raise the possibility of returning to the 2015 nuclear deal negotiated when he was vice president under Barack Obama. Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, said Tuesday that the U.S. election result would have no effect on Tehran's policies towards Washington. Via remote, Laurel Bowman, VOA News.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
It is because the first round had succeeded, that's why Nigerian youth are emboldened and feel inspired to go on another round to demand for the implementation of the promises made. It was a success and it has changed Nigeria forever.
Nigerian groups plan fresh nationwide protests Monday.
There is nobody actually holding factions accountable. International structures have failed the population. National structures are also coming down in the same light. The people seem to be shouting in one room by themselves.
A major Cameroonian women's group demands immediate ceasefire to enable a resolution of the ongoing conflict.
CCM is determined to have no democracy. It is determined to run a one-party thugocracy. And this man has spent years and years trying to bring democracy and freedom to his people. This is just one more step along the way.
And fearing for his life, the Tanzanian main opposition leader Tundu Lissu seeks refuge at the residence of the German ambassador. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. In Nigeria, civil society groups are calling for yet another nationwide protest beginning Monday. The protest, they say, will pressure the administration to meet their demands. Key among them include the inclusion of the youth in the country's politics, as well as an end to police brutality, including extrajudicial killings. But critics say the protests appear to have failed to live up to their promise. They say the government has yet to meet all of the protesters' demands. They also accuse the organizers of creating tension and clashes with the police. Attorney Bulama Bukati is a human rights activist and a major proponent of the protest. He tells me that Nigerians want accountability from the leaders and for the West African country to be effectively administered to meet the aspirations of the people.
I completely support any attempt to continue the protest, and I can tell you those of us that wouldn't start on Monday have also been discussing how to start another round of protests. That's because government has clearly shown bad faith in the promises and commitments they made in the first round of protests. For example, the president of Nigeria has declared repeatedly that he recognizes the right of Nigerians to peacefully protest. But news have been coming out of Nigeria in the past few days on how the leaders of the last round of protests are being harassed and persecuted by the government. Their accounts are being arbitrarily frozen by the Central Bank of Nigeria. Some of them have had their passports confiscated. Protesters who were injured in the last round of protests at Lekki in Lagos are still going about with their wounds untreated because the government has brought pressure on hospitals not to treat them. This is the highest sign of bad faith you can ever find.
Are you not worried that there could be violence? Protesters could clash with the police.
It is a concern, but then the issue is this is a deliberate scheme by the government to scare protesters, to terrorize protesters and stop us from exercising our constitutionally guaranteed rights. The police are not hoodlums. They are working under the commands of the government. If the government doesn't want the public harmed, why would they bring the police to continue to harass and kill protesters? They might likely do it on Monday. We have kept telling them that the world is watching, history is watching, and we would continue to exercise our constitutional right. Nobody would bully us into silence. We are not out to destroy our country. We are out to ask for better from our leaders. And we don't see any reason why the police should be employed to kill us and to tear gas us and to harass us just because we are exercising our constitutional right.
Bulama, there's this issue where some governors have signed onto measures to regulate social media because they said social media is being used as a fake news avenue, you know, to encourage the youth to create chaos, disunity and tension in Nigeria. Some of your critics are saying that the organizers of this youth are to blame. for this move by some governors to support the measures to regulate social media in Nigeria. How do you respond to that?
The attempt to regulate social media, to censor social media, and to stifle freedom of expression in Nigeria started well before the NSAS protest. But you are right that after what the success of NSAS, and because social media was a big part of the most recent round of protests, they felt the best way to go is not to to tackle the problems we spoke about. We are asking for an end to police impunity, to violation of human rights. We are asking for better from our government. But instead of them to deliver good governance, I felt the best way to go about stopping protests in Nigeria is not to give the protesters what they want, it is to stifle social media. And where did they get it from? The Minister of Communication has told us where they got that idea from. He said it was from China.
Bulama, some people are disputing organizers of the NSAS protest that it was successful. Some are saying it wasn't successful. All their demands have not necessarily been met. And that is why some groups of people are organizing yet another protest beginning Monday to pressure the government. What is your take on that?
The NSAS protest was a great accomplishment. I can tell you it was unprecedented success in the history of Nigeria. Nigerian youth came out en masse. The government started by using force against protesters, and then they started making promises that were not acceptable to protesters. And at the end of the day, we forced the president to relent. We forced him to announce the disbandment of SARS and that he had accepted all the five demands made by us. The next round of protests, therefore, is building on the success of the first one. And what are we asking for in the second round of protests? They have made the commitment in the first round. Now we want them to implement the commitments they made. We want them to deliver on the promises they made. It is because the first round had succeeded, that's why Nigerian youth are emboldened and feel inspired to go on another round to demand for the implementation of the promises made. It was a success, and it has changed Nigeria forever.
Attorney Bulama Bukati is a Nigerian human rights activist and a major proponent of the protest. He spoke with me from the capital, Abuja. The leader of the Cameroonian Women's Civil Society Group is reiterating calls on the government and on separatists for a ceasefire to allow for dialogue to resolve the crisis. Sally Mbomian, leader of the Northwest Southwest Women Task Force, rejects accusations that women's groups have been shielding separatists from arrest. Her remarks come after six school children were buried last week. The government blames the separatists for their murder, an accusation they deny. Sally Mbomian tells me that it is unacceptable for children and women to be killed due to the ongoing conflict between the government and separatists from the English-speaking parts of the country.
Our group has been collaborating with other women's groups to mourn the death of the children in Kumba. Our group particularly has written an open letter to the government, UN bodies and the fighters on their adamant nature, ignoring our ceasefire call.
But Sally, I understand some officials are blaming women groups from shielding some of these separatist fighters who they accuse of killing these young children from being apprehended by the authorities. What do you say to that?
It's normal for conflict time for women to be victimized over and over again. Yes, administrative officials receive some women and said the women are hiding the children who are committing this act. I would want to categorically say that is shifting blame and refusing to take responsibility. Because just like the administrators who are struggling to get those boys lay down their arms, these women too have been talking to the boys. If you have been listening to women's movement, I want to talk particularly about SNOT. There is no time we have not appealed and called on these boys to calm and put down and discuss the issues and stop the violence. To me, it's just shifting and blaming from end to end without doing the right thing. We are telling all factions no to violence. Cease your fire now. Talk to each other. No matter your challenges, we are tired of this excessive bloodshed.
Is your group, as well as other women's groups,
across the country, seeing the recent murder of these children as a watershed moment to redouble your efforts in putting pressure on the conflicting sides to address this issue about the ongoing crisis and resolve it?
Since these children were murdered in Kumba, the women are pained, they are at grief. But we are certain as women that this is the turning point. Whichever faction, the government of the country, the separatist leader, what happened in Kumba on innocent children is the time for everybody to change.
The women are saying that in as much as all of them are agreed on the fact that the act of killing the child, the children in Kumba is wrong, they condemn it in strong terms, and they blame each other for it. The women are saying that they can do much more than that. And the logical thing to do at this moment is for them to cease fire, that is categorically denouncing violence and hostilities, and coming together to hold peace negotiations. Remember, the killing of the children in Kumba came barely 5 or 6 days after the 30 days call that the women gave in the previous ceasefire to these factions had passed. Why the women were mobilizing to still call on them that they are disrespecting the women and children that they claim in all their strong speeches to be protecting, then these children were killed in Kumba. I will use this medium to tell the factions, the government of Cameroon, that the carnage that took place in Kumba, the murder of young Cameroonians, destroying the generation, young children, destroying generations unborn, it's a clarion call for them to step up their game. That is, protect the women and children practically by apologizing to the population for not performing their duty of protecting us, because if the separatists believe that they have a country, in that country they have to protect its citizens. The government of Cameroon, in defending state sovereignty, has to protect its citizens. So because these children, helpless civilians, were killed, they have to apologize to the population and do what is right to stop violence permanently.
Sally, why do you think your efforts, as well as other partners of yours, to have these conflicting sides cease fire, to engage in dialogue to resolve this crisis, appear to have not been effective?
Our effort seems not to be yielding fruits, because the pathetic thing about the current conflict in Cameroon is the blame game. It is the manipulation on media where people shout, people justify evil and frighten the population into silence. There is nobody actually holding factions accountable. International structures have failed the population. National structures are also coming down in the same light. The people seem to be shouting in one room by themselves.
Sally Mbomian is leader of the Northwest Southwest Women Task Force. She spoke with me from the Cameroonian capital, Yaoundé. An attorney for Tanzania's main opposition leader says Tundu Lissu has sought refuge at the residence of the German ambassador. Robert Amsterdam says Tundu Lissu went there due to threat to his life. This following reports that his life was in danger after rejecting the outcome of the last election, citing voter irregularities and rigging. Lissu survived an assassination attempt which forced him to seek medical attention overseas for 3 years. He returned this year to become the main opposition presidential candidate to challenge incumbent President John Magufuli. Attorney Robert Amsterdam tells me that he plans to present evidence of police violence against the Tanzanian opposition to the International Criminal Court beginning next week. He also expressed gratitude to the German embassy for allowing his client to stay there.
We're grateful to the German government that they are harboring him at this time.
Is he going to seek asylum?
I mean, that's a decision that has yet to be made.
We understand that Tanzanian police say they are unaware of any threat to Tundu Lissu's life. What is your reaction as his lawyer to this claim by the senior police official?
These people after he was shot 16 times, after all of the cameras that would have covered the shooting were confiscated by these very people. I will tell you, the police in Tanzania, we are having them investigated by the ICC, so don't believe them. Just because they use that title doesn't mean they're actually police who torture, beat, and maim political opponents of the government on orders. This is not a government. This is a junta of people who never won the election, who canceled the internet, who burnt and destroyed people's homes who they felt were opponents. This is not a normal government, and don't give them the presumption of regularity. They stole this election. They're not a government.
How long is your client, Mr. Lusu, planning to stay at the German ambassador's residence?
I don't believe there's a formal plan yet. I think the diplomats are talking to, people in the CCM to determine next steps.
Some people are suggesting that if he's seeking cover and protection from a foreign country, what should his supporters who are exposed and who do not necessarily have that kind of protection do?
Well, let's be clear. Mr. Lisu was shot 16 times and has already barely survived an assassination attempt. His supporters should be peacefully protesting, as he asked them to do, before he sought asylum to avoid a second attempt at his murder. Mr. Lisu has been a hero who has stared down the violent CCM thugs who dogged him every day of his campaign. And many of the key leaders of Chadema are now free again to lead peaceful protests.
Has he spoken to you about his next line of action?
We are discussing it, but while he's in the embassy, we're going to be very cautious about what we say concerning his plans.
Mm. Have you or anybody you know reached out to the government to really understand why he is allegedly being targeted by the administration?
Look, the government, as they are called, we don't treat them as if they're a logical government. And I really think it's important for people in the media to get rid of this presumption of regularity, sir. Don't call them a government. They stole the election completely. And it is clear to every embassy in Tanzania, it's clear to observer after observer exactly what they did. And it's clear to anybody who follows the situation, because trust me, if they had taken 84% of the vote, there'd have been celebrations in the street. There was nobody. They wouldn't have had to close the internet down. They wouldn't have had to deploy the entire army on the street.
Robert, when do you plan on presenting the evidence that you have gathered of the alleged atrocities that you talked about against or targeting opposition supporters to the International Criminal Court?
It's a process. It's beginning next week. But, you know, quite honestly, the ICC is only one step. There will be hearings in parliaments around the world. There will be sanctions. There will be protests in Tanzania. You know, what I would say to those people in the CCM is they haven't won anything. And Chadema and ACT and the other opposition parties are not going to give them this election out of fear or anything else.
Let me ask you this, Robert, before you go. How is Tundu Lisu feeling at the moment after seeking refuge at the German embassy?
I think he sees it all as par for the course. I mean, he's been fighting these thugs for years and years. CCM is determined to have no democracy. It is determined to run a one-party thugocracy. And this man has spent years and years trying to bring democracy and freedom to his people. This is just one more step along the way.
Robert Amsterdam is attorney for Tanzania's main opposition leader, Tundu Lisu. He spoke with me from the British capital, London. The Lesotho Information Ministry has launched a digital innovation program aimed at creating opportunities for the country's youth. Information Minister Thesele Masiribani says the program will significantly boost the problem-solving skills of the youth so they can come up with solutions to help resolve the challenges facing the Southern African Kingdom. Analysts say if well administered, the program can help transform the lives of young people by sharply reducing high unemployment and setting them on a path to success. To learn more about the program and the government's recently launched nationwide cleanup campaign, I reach Information Minister Thesele Masiribani.
As you know, that every country has its own vision and it has also earmarked by the World Vision, also by the UN Vision or African Union Vision, that by 2020 or by 2023 or 2063 will be supporting our economy through digital innovation. So we have taken a step further to say that in Lesotho, we see that we need to encourage our young scientists, our young innovators, by giving them an opportunity to display their prototypes. Only for Lesotho, this is our first step. We're not inviting other huge innovators coming from other countries, but we would like to see what we can get out of our country. We have a National University Innovation Hub, which is also going to be taking place. In the ministry, we have our appropriate technology services, which is also going to be taking place in the innovation display or exhibition. That will be next year around April. But before that, we're going to have district innovation days that will be in every district to encourage young people to come up with their smart ideas.
How has been the response of the Lesotho citizens that you are giving this opportunity to so far?
When the cabinet gave me an approval, it was an excitement moment for our department. It was those who approached us in two fronts, young scientists, even young old scientists, they applauded that move, the right move we are taking for Lesotho. And people will come and say, look, I saw something in Lesotho that a young man does. And then you'll be given an opportunity to come to America, maybe come and work for a big company and say, improve on that.
We understand your government has also launched a nationwide cleaning campaign. Tell me why.
You need to consider some other issues, my brother. That if you know that your own house is not clean, there is no way you can talk about point fingers at other people's yards. Your backyard it's not clean. We're having a serious challenge about this. The waste is a challenge to the whole world. We know that there are smart ways of dealing with waste to recycle it, make it into energy. We know that there are so many smart ways of dealing with waste by making it bricks, cardboard bricks to burn to warm our people with. So it is a challenge that it is affecting our environment as a small country. And remember that how the country of Lesotho is built. It's got mountains. Everything flashes goes and down the river, and it is affecting our underground water. So there are so many factors that we needed to take action as a government of Lesotho to bring back the culture of Moshoeshoe, of our kings, our forefathers.
With what you have just said, there was an enforcement mechanism that encouraged the people to be neat, to clean their environment, and to ensure that the environment is neat. Are you having that same mechanism to encourage people in this national or nationwide cleaning up campaign?
We are looking at the government for to find a way how we can be able to make it a legal a law that will force every Mosotho not just to throw a litter all over. It's not only Basotho. There are so many cultures that we're having in our country. Maybe in their own culture they don't behave like we behave. So we want to make a law so that it binds everybody that comes to Lesotho, that you cannot just stand and throw things around. We want to deal away with the plastic and come up with something that will afford our wives and myself when you go to the mall to carry back groceries or our clothes.
Fesele Masribane is Lesotho's information minister. He spoke with me from the capital, Maseru.
Take your pick, watch on television, log on to the internet, or listen right here on the radio. Hello, I am Shaka Salih, the host of Straight Talk Africa from the Voice of America. Straight Talk Africa puts you in touch with newsmakers and experts as they talk about the most important social and political issues that affect you. Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
is the Voice of America and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host Peter Clotte in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Mpuga and music from our African collection. But first, the founder and executive director of the Nonprofit Institute for African Women in Law is calling on the African Union to endorse Uganda's Judge Julia Sebutinde. The Ugandan Judge Sebutinde seeks re-election on the bench of the International Court of Justice, ICJ. The election is scheduled for November 11 to fill five judicial positions on the court. Japa Dawuni, who is also Associate Professor of Political Science at Howard University, tells me that the upcoming election presents a unique opportunity to members of the African Union to boost Judge Sebutinde's electoral prospects at the Hague-based court.
Yeah, the International Court of Justice is one of the oldest, if not the oldest, court in the world. Next year, it will be celebrating its 75th anniversary. And in over 74 years of the court's existence, it's had over 109 judges. And out of the 109, only four have been women. And so women have represented less than 4% of the judges on the International Court of Justice, making it one of the lowest numbers in the world.
Among those who are competing, what is the percentage of women?
So the elections will be held by the Security Council and the General Assembly of the United Nations simultaneously. There are eight judges who are contesting for the five seats available. And out of the eight judges, three of them are women. And two out of the three women are contesting for re-election. So there's only one new candidate, the candidate from Croatia, who is standing for a first term nomination and election.
Is there an African among those contesting for this position?
Yes. Out of the three women, there's one African woman, Judge Julia Sebutinde of Uganda.
Who is Judge Sebutinde?
Judge Sebutinde is the first African woman to serve on the court. She was elected in 2012, so her nine-year term is coming to an end. According to the court, a judge can be re-elected for a second term, making it a maximum of 18 years. Before Judge Sebutinde came, there had been 14 African men who had served on judges on the court. And each of these 14 judges were supported by the African Union or the African Group of States to stand for a second term of election. So this is the first time that Judge Sebutinde, as the first woman, is going to be contesting for re-election to the court for her second term.
Why do you think it's significant that African states support her candidacy?
The norm, even though it's not necessarily a written rule, has been that the African Union or the OAU at that time, this court has been in existence since 1946. So the OAU or the AU, as we have it now, have always come out to support the incumbent. In this case, the incumbent is Judge Julia Sebutinde. But this time around, there has been a lot of politics also going on whereby the African Union has not expressly come out to endorse her. In addition to her, two candidates have been added on to the Africa plate. So one candidate from Rwanda and the other one from Nigeria. Judge Julia Sebutinde has over 41 years of experience as a judge. So we are not making the advocacy for her to be re-elected or re-nominated or endorsed by the African Union just because of gender. She has the experience. She's served on international courts such as the Special Court for Sierra Leone. She has served going on nine years at the ICJ. She's written over 65 judgments and other opinions that have been important for the decolonization of the African state. So with all of this, she comes with a lot of experience. She's done a good job so far in her 9 years. And I think it's just the right thing for the African Union to endorse her, like they did with all the 14 other judges before her. So the question for us is, why is it that the first African woman who is contesting for re-election has not been expressly endorsed? Beyond gender, it's hard to figure out what else could be going on. But we do know that elections to international courts also involve a lot of high-level politics. So the African Union should come out, endorse the incumbent, and let the chips fall where they may, and let the strongest candidate come out.
What do you think are the electoral prospects, Judge Sebutinde?
Well, it's always hard to tell, as you agree with me, but we see with the current ongoing electoral issues in the United States in terms of counting of votes. The elections at the ICJ are also based on a secret ballot. And it's also not just based on the merit or judicial record. It's also based on geopolitics and a lot of diplomacy. So there is some horse trading that happens within the United Nations, whereby states can shift their gains and their losses and vote for different candidates. So in as much as Judge Julia Sebutinde has a lot of experience, she has the merit and the qualifications, and it's left up to states to decide for themselves who they want for which region for different calculations. Overall, I'm hopeful that Judge Sebutinde has the prospects of being re-elected. If the African Group of States will support a strong candidate, I think she's the one. It's not because of her gender, but in terms of the record, beyond the Africa region, it's also important for the rest of the world. She's a good and a strong, excellent judge. And if we go into the international level, gender has to be taken into consideration. And I think the elected members of the Security Council and General Assembly should look into the gender aspect of these elections as well.
Japa Dauni is the founder and executive director of the Nonprofit Institute for African Women in Law. She is also an associate professor of political science at Howard University. She spoke with me from here in Washington, D.C. UN High Commissioner for Human Rights Michelle Bachelet is calling for a halt to violence in Ethiopia and for contentious differences there to be resolved through dialogue. For VOA, Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
Ethiopia's stability is on the line as the recent outbursts of fierce fighting in the country's Tigray and Oromia regions risks getting out of hand. UN Rights Chief Michelle Bachelet is calling for a de-escalation of violence and for grievances in these separate but equally destructive conflicts to be settled peacefully. Heavy clashes broke out Wednesday in the northern region of Tigray between federal and regional troops, prompting declaration of a 6-month state of emergency. The Ethiopian government announced it had deployed federal troops in response to an alleged attack by the Tigray People's Liberation Front on a military base. Bachelet spokeswoman Ravina Shamdasani tells VOA the eruption of fighting follows months of growing tensions between the federal government and authorities of the Tigray regional state.
This is really quite an alarming flare-up of these tensions, which have now entered into a phase of violence. And since then, it has been very difficult to get information about what exactly is happening on the ground because there's been an internet shutdown and phone lines have also been cut. So we're very worried, especially as we're not able to access information about the impact of the clashes on civilians.
Bachelet also deplores an attack by a group of armed men against members of the Amhara ethnic group in the Oromia region Sunday. The government reports 32 people have been killed, although other sources report many more casualties. Shamdasani says Bachelet is concerned about the lack of proper investigations and accountability into past similarly deadly incidents.
What that means is that people are left desolate, feeling like there are entire communities that are pitted against each other, and this then provides fertile ground for further intercommunal clashes, more casualties.
Shamdasani says Bachelet is calling on the government this time around to ensure prompt, thorough, independent, and impartial investigations into these incidents and to ensure that those responsible are held individually accountable. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Mpuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. The Confederation of African Football, CAF, has issued guidelines for the upcoming qualifying matches for the 2022 Africa Cup of Nations. In the guidelines, any national team unable to play due to COVID restrictions will be deemed to have lost the game 2-0. Also, a team will be considered to have lost 2-0 if it is unable to field the minimum number of players required, that's 11 players plus 4 substitutes. The guidelines also say that all matches must be played behind closed doors, although national football associations can ask for special permission to have fans in. Usually squads for these qualifying matches are bigger, but some national team managers have expressed concern about the ability to get players, especially those based in Europe, to play in Africa amid fears they could get COVID-19. Meanwhile, Zamalek scored 2 late goals as they came from behind to beat Raja Casablanca 3-1 in Cairo to set up an All-Egyptian African Champions League final against Al Ahly. The final will be played on November 27th at the Borg Al Arab Stadium near Alexandria. This will be the competition's first title decider between clubs from the same country. It will also be the first time the final will not be played over two legs, a decision taken in June last year before the global COVID-19 pandemic. In rugby, world champion South Africa have committed to the Rugby Championship until 2030. The Springboks withdrew from the 2020 tournament because of fears over player welfare amid coronavirus pandemic. There have been reports South Africa were planning to join the Six Nations in 2024 after the next World Cup. But South Africa Rugby is reportedly fine with the plans to restructure the tournament, which also includes New Zealand, Australia and Argentina. In athletics, Britain's Laura Moore has been nominated for this year's World Athletics Female Athlete of the Year Award. The 27-year-old Moore is the quickest in the world over 1,500 meters this season and set a new UK 1,000 meters record in August. Of the 10 nominees, Moore is the only Briton in the running for the award, which was won last year by Dalila Mohammed of the United States. Faith Kipyegon of Kenya, who ran world-leading races over 800 meters and 1,000 meters, and Letesenebet Gide of Ethiopia, who recently set a 5,000 meters world record, are among the nominees. In the men's category, nominations include Jacob Kiplimo, who made history by becoming the first Ugandan to win gold in the half marathon in a record 58 minutes and 49 seconds. In all, five African women are nominated. That's Abel Yeshane and Gide of Ethiopia, Perez Jepchechir, Faith Kipyegon and Helen Obiri of Kenya. There are also three African male nominees, Joshua Cheptegei and Jacob Kiplimo of Uganda, and Timothy Cheruiyot of Kenya. The winners will be announced at the World Athletics Awards 2020 on Saturday, December 5th. Finally, in boxing, Dillian White's rematch with Alexander Povetkin has been postponed after the Russian tested positive for coronavirus. The 41-year-old Povetkin produced a stunning knockout win over the British heavyweight in August, and the pair were due to fight again on November 21st. And that's it for this edition of Nathan Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from the continent.
People go. zobambi matu mazaka sera na kukumbe gira mani ntakate matu kaja sinkane mkuze mkuze mwaka mzo mwero tiana yekwe wema siwo mwawero wako kachai mwema sao sukari mwema vida kajiko noche tenkanya
we go drop the
Emma Spain.
Business then they close.
tell we say you able to talk about them. But all of a sudden, you know the show start with them. Now we tire with yesterday, wahala. But the talent say, not from tattoo to yawa. Lape na figu, yes, now don't rub so. Not see me body so. That's so so cool, what I let me not take lily money anymore. But go buy toy, call a spade a spade. Get up close and put in the question.
I've been the feels. yesterday better pass today.
Our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America in Washington. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoyed the program tonight. As you know by now, we're on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, Managing Editor Shaka Saleh, Reporter Douglas Mpuga, and Producer Saida Hamdoun, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, people are people through other people. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.